Since then he is always touching, with his feet and every part of him, the softest parts of the softest things, he must be supremely tender. So he is youngest and tenderest, and besides these, supple in form. If he were rigid, he could not fold himself around us on every side, nor pass unnoticed through every soul as he enters and leaves. Strong proof of his well-proportioned and supple figure is his gracefulness, which by universal agreement love possesses beyond all others. Between gracelessness and love, there is perpetual war. The god's beauty of complexion is shown by his living among flowers, where there is no bloom, or the bloom has faded, in body, in soul, in anything whatever, love will not settle. But wherever a spot is flowery and fragrant, there he settles and there he stays. About the god's beauty this is enough, though much still remains. After this, we must speak of love's virtue. The greatest point is that love neither wrongs nor is wronged, not by a god, not against a god, not by a man, not against a man. He does not suffer by force, if he suffers at all, for force does not touch love, nor does he act by force when he acts, since everyone serves love in everything willingly, and whatever one willing party agrees with another willing party, the laws, those kings of the city, declare to be just. And beyond justice, he has the fullest share of moderation. Moderation is agreed to be mastery over pleasures and desires, and no pleasure is stronger than love. So if they are weaker, they are mastered by love, and he is master, and being master over pleasures and desires, love would be moderate beyond all others. And as for courage, not even Ares can stand up to love. For it is not Ares who holds love, but love who holds Ares, love for Aphrodite, so the story goes, and the one who holds is stronger than the one held, and mastering the most courageous of all the rest, he would be the most courageous of all. Now the god's justice, moderation, and courage have been spoken of, his wisdom remains, and one must try, as far as possible, to leave nothing out. First, so that I too may honor our art as Eryximachus honored his. The god is a poet so skilled that he can make a poet of another. At any rate, everyone becomes a poet, however unmusical he was before, whom love touches. This we may fittingly use as evidence that love is a good poet, a maker, in short, of every kind of creation that belongs to the muses. For what one does not have, or does not know, one can neither give to another nor teach him. And as for the making of all living things, who will deny that this is love's wisdom, by which every animal comes into being and grows? And in the craftsman's arts, don't we know that whoever has this god for a teacher turns out famous and brilliant, while whoever love never touches stays in the dark? Archery, medicine, prophecy, Apollo discovered them all with desire and love leading the way, so he too must count as love's pupil. And so with the muses in music, Hephaestus in metalwork, Athena in weaving, and Zeus in steering gods and men alike. That is why the affairs of the gods were set in order, once love was born among them, love of beauty, obviously, since love has nothing to do with ugliness. Before that, as I said at the start, all sorts of terrible things happened among the gods, so the story goes, under the reign of necessity. But once this god was born, from loving beautiful things every good thing has come, for gods and for human beings. So it seems to me, Phaedrus, that love is first himself the most beautiful and the best, and after that the cause of the same qualities in others. And I feel moved to put something in verse, that he is the one who makes peace among men, and on the open sea a windless calm, who lays the winds to bed, and gives sleep to the troubled. He is the one who empties us of estrangement and fills us with belonging, who brings us together in every gathering like this one, taking the lead at festivals, at dances, at sacrifices. He supplies gentleness and banishes savagery. Generous with goodwill, stingy with ill will. Gracious kind, a sight for the wise, a wonder to the gods, envied by those who lack him, treasured by those who have him, father of luxury, delicacy, elegance, of graces and longing and desire, careful of the good, careless of the bad, in hardship, in fear, in longing, in speech, the finest steersman, shipmate, comrade in arms, and rescuer. The ornament of all gods and men together, the leader most beautiful and best, whom every man should follow, singing his praises beautifully, joining in the song he sings, as he charms the mind of every god and every human being. There, Phaedrus, he said, let that speech of mine be dedicated to the god, part playfulness, part measured seriousness, as far as my powers allow. When Agathon finished, Aristodemus said, everyone present burst into applause. The young man had spoken in a way worthy of himself and of the god. Then Socrates looked at Eryximachus and said, well, son of Acumenes, do you still think the fear I've been fearing was groundless? Wasn't I a prophet when I said just now that Agathon would speak marvelously and I would be stuck for words? On one point, said Eryximachus, I grant you spoke like a prophet. Agathon did speak well. But that you'll be stuck. I doubt it. My dear man, said Socrates, how could I not be stuck? How could anyone not be, having to speak after a speech so beautiful and so rich? The rest of it was not all equally astonishing, but that ending, who could hear the beauty of those words and phrases and not be struck dumb? For my part, when I realized I wouldn't be able to say anything even close to that beautiful, I nearly ran off in shame. I would have, if I'd had anywhere to go. The speech kept reminding me of Gorgias, so that I found myself in exactly Homer's predicament. I was terrified that Agathon would end by sending the head of Gorgias, that terror of a speaker, against my speech, and turn me to stone, speechless. And then I realized what a fool I'd been when I agreed to take my turn with you in praising love, and claimed to be an expert in matters of love, knowing nothing, as it turns out, about the business, about how anything ought to be praised. In my stupidity, I thought you should tell the truth about whatever is being praised, that this was the foundation, and from these truths you'd pick out the most beautiful points and arrange them as attractively as possible. And I was quite proud of myself, sure I'd speak well, since I knew the truth about praising anything. But apparently, that's not what fine praising is at all. Apparently, it's ascribing to the thing the greatest and most beautiful qualities you can, whether it actually has them or not, and if it's all false, no matter. The proposal, it seems, was that each of us should appear to praise love, not that we should actually praise him. That, I suppose, is why you rake up every possible claim and attribute it to love, and declare him to be such and such and the cause of so much, to make him appear as beautiful and as good as possible, obviously to people who don't know him, surely not to those who do, and the praise sounds fine and impressive. But I, it turns out, didn't know this style of praising, and it was in my ignorance that I agreed to take my turn at praise. The tongue promised, the mind did not. So goodbye to all that. I am not going to give an encomium that way, I couldn't. But the truth, if you like, I'm willing to tell the truth, in my own fashion, not in competition with your speeches, or I'd only make myself ridiculous. So decide, Phaedrus, whether there's any use for a speech like that, hearing the truth told about love, in whatever words and arrangement of phrases happen to come. Phaedrus and the others, he said, urged him to speak in whatever way he himself thought best. Then one more thing, Phaedrus, he said, let me ask Agathon a few small questions, so that I can get his agreement first, and then speak on that basis. You have my leave, said Phaedrus, ask away. After that, he said, Socrates began from roughly this point. Truly, my dear Agathon, I thought you opened your speech beautifully, when you said one should first show what sort of being love is, and afterward his works. I admire that beginning very much. So come, since you described everything else about what love is so beautifully and magnificently, tell me this too. Is love such as to be love of something or of nothing? I'm not asking whether he is the love of some mother or father. The question, whether love is love of a mother or father, would be absurd. But as if I were asking about the very word father, is a father the father of something or not? You would tell me, presumably, if you wanted to answer properly, that a father is father of a son or a daughter. Wouldn't you? Certainly, said Agathon. And the same for a mother. He agreed to that too. Then answer a little more, said Socrates, so you'll see better what I'm after. Suppose I asked, what about a brother, just insofar as he is a brother, is he a brother of someone or not?
He said he is.
Of a brother or a sister, then.
He agreed.
Now try to say the same about love, said Socrates. Is love love of nothing or of something?
Of something, certainly.
Well then, said Socrates, keep that safe in your mind, remember what it's of. For now just tell me this, does love desire the thing he is love of or not?
Certainly, he said.
And does he desire and love it, while having the very thing he desires and loves, or while not having it?
Not having it, he said, most likely.
Then consider, said Socrates, whether instead of merely likely it isn't necessary, that what desires, desires what it lacks, and doesn't desire unless it lacks. To me, Agathon, it seems astonishingly clear that it's necessary.
What do you think?
I think so too, he said.
Well said.
Now, would anyone who is tall want to be tall, or anyone strong want to be strong?
Impossible, from what we've agreed.
Because the one who already is those things can't be lacking them.
True.
For if someone strong wanted to be strong, said Socrates, and someone fast to be fast, and someone healthy to be healthy, since one might perhaps suppose, in these and all such cases, that people who are like this and have these qualities also desire the very things they have, and I say this so we won't be misled. If you think about it, Agathon, these people necessarily have, at the present moment, each of the things they have, whether they want to or not, and who would desire that? But when someone says, I am healthy and I also want to be healthy, I am rich and I also want to be rich, and I desire the very things I have, we would tell him, what you mean, my friend, is that having acquired wealth and health and strength, you want to go on possessing them into the future, since in the present, whether you want to or not, you have them. So when you say, I desire what I already have, consider whether you mean anything but this. I want what is now present to me to remain present in the future as well.
He'd have to agree, wouldn't he?
Agathon said yes.
So then, said Socrates, isn't that loving the thing that isn't yet ready to hand for him, the thing he doesn't have, namely, that these things be preserved for him and present in time to come?
Certainly, he said.
So this man, and everyone else who desires, desires what isn't ready to hand and isn't present, what he doesn't have, what he himself isn't, what he lacks, these are the sorts of things desire and love are of.
Absolutely, he said.
Come then, said Socrates, let's sum up what's been said. Love is, first, of certain things, and second, of whatever things he currently lacks.
Isn't that so?
Yes, he said.
Now, with that settled, remember what things you said love is love of in your speech. Or if you like, I'll remind you. I believe you said something like this, that the affairs of the gods were set in order through love of beautiful things, for there could be no love of ugly ones.
Wasn't that roughly what you said?
I did say it, said Agathon. And a fair thing to say, my friend, said Socrates.
And if that's so, love would be love of beauty and not of ugliness.
He agreed.
Now we agreed that he loves what he lacks and doesn't have.
Yes, he said.
Then love lacks beauty and doesn't have it.
Necessarily, he said.
Well then, what lacks beauty and possesses no beauty at all, do you call that beautiful?
Certainly not.
Then do you still maintain that love is beautiful, if all this is so?
And Agathon said, I'm afraid, Socrates, I knew nothing of what I was talking about.
And yet you spoke beautifully, Agathon, he said. But one small thing more, don't you think good things are also beautiful?
I do.
Then if love lacks beautiful things, and good things are beautiful, he would lack good things too.
Socrates, he said, I can't argue with you.
Let it be as you say.
No, dear Agathon, he said, it's the truth you can't argue with. Arguing with Socrates is easy enough. And now I'll let you go.
Instead, the account of love that I once heard from a woman of Mantinea, Diotima, wise in this and in many other things. She once got the Athenians, when they made their sacrifices before the plague, a 10-year postponement of the disease. And she is the one who taught me the ways of love, the account she gave, I'll try to go through for you on my own, starting from what Agathon and I have agreed, as best I can. As you laid it out, Agathon, one must first describe love himself, who he is and what he's like, and then his works.
I think it's easiest to go through it the way the stranger once went through it with me, questioning me as she went. For I was saying to her pretty much the same sorts of things Agathon was saying to me just now, that love is a great god, and that he is love of beautiful things. And she refuted me with the very arguments I used on him, showing that by my own account love is neither beautiful nor good.
And I said, what do you mean, Diotima?
Is love ugly, then, and bad?
And she said, watch your tongue.
Do you really think that whatever isn't beautiful must be ugly?
Certainly.
And can something be ignorant without being wise?
Wait, haven't you noticed there's something in between wisdom and ignorance?
What's that?
Having a correct opinion without being able to give a reasoned account of it.
Don't you see that this is neither knowledge, for how could something without a reasoned account be knowledge?
Nor ignorance, for how could something that hits on what's true be ignorance?
Correct opinion is surely something of this sort, between understanding and ignorance.
What you say is true, I said.
Then don't force what isn't beautiful to be ugly, or what isn't good to be bad.
And likewise with love. Since you yourself admit he isn't good or beautiful, don't think for that reason he must be ugly and bad, but rather something in between the two.
And yet, I said, everyone agrees he's a great god.
Everyone who doesn't know, you mean, or everyone including those who do know.
All of them together.
And she laughed and said, how could it be agreed, Socrates, that he's a great god? By people who say he isn't even a god at all.
Who are these people?
I asked.
You're one, she said, and I'm another.
How do you mean?
I said.
Easily, she said.
Tell me, don't you say all gods are happy and beautiful?
Or would you dare say any god is not beautiful and happy?
By Zeus, not I said.
And by happy you mean those who possess what's good and beautiful.
Certainly.
But you've admitted that love, for lack of good and beautiful things, desires the very things he lacks.
I have.
Then how could he be a god, if he has no share in what's good and beautiful?
He couldn't, it seems.
So you see, she said, that you too don't think love is a god.
Then what could love be?
I asked.
Mortal.
Far from it.
Then what?
As before, something between mortal and immortal.
What is that, Diotima?
A great spirit, Socrates, for everything spiritual is between God and mortal.
With what power?
I asked.
Interpreting and ferrying between gods and men what comes from each, from men their prayers and sacrifices, from the gods their commands, and the returns due for sacrifices, and being in the middle of both, it fills up the space between, so that the whole is bound together with itself.
Through this power all divination proceeds, and the whole art of priests, concerned with sacrifices, rites, incantations, every kind of prophecy and sorcery. God does not mix with man directly, but all the intercourse and conversation between gods and men, whether they're awake or asleep, happens through this power. And the man who is skilled in such matters is a man of spirit, while a man skilled in anything else, some craft or handiwork, is merely a workman. These spirits are many and of every kind, and love is one of them. And who are his father and mother?
I asked.
That's rather a long story, she said, but I'll tell you anyway. When Aphrodite was born, the gods held a feast, and among them was Resource, the son of Cunning. When they had dined, Poverty came begging, as one does when there's a banquet going on, and stood by the doors. Now Resource, drunk on nectar, for there was no wine yet, went into the garden of Zeus, and heavy with drink, fell asleep. Poverty, scheming because of her own lack of means to get a child from Resource, lay down beside him and conceived Love. That's why Love became the follower and attendant of Aphrodite. He was born at her birthday feast, and he is also by nature a lover of beauty, since Aphrodite herself is beautiful. So, being the son of Resource and Poverty, Love finds himself in this condition. First, he's always poor, and far from being delicate and beautiful, as most people think. Instead, he's rough, unkempt, barefoot, homeless, always sleeping on the bare ground without a bed, lying in doorways and along roadsides under the open sky, having his mother's nature, always dwelling with need. But taking after his father, he schemes to get what's beautiful and good, being bold, impetuous, and intense, a formidable hunter, always weaving some new device, desiring understanding and resourceful in getting it, philosophizing his whole life long, a clever sorcerer, druggist, and sophist. He's not naturally immortal, nor mortal either, but on one and the same day he sometimes flourishes and lives, when he's resourceful, and sometimes he dies, but comes back to life again through his father's nature. Yet whatever he gets always slips away, so that Love is never without means, nor ever rich, and he stands in between wisdom and ignorance as well.
Here's how it stands.
None of the gods pursue wisdom or desire to become wise, for they already are, nor does anyone else who is already wise pursue it. Nor, in turn, do the ignorant pursue wisdom or desire to become wise, for this is exactly what makes ignorance so difficult, that a person who is neither beautiful and good nor sensible seems to himself to be quite adequate. The one who doesn't think he's in need doesn't desire the thing he doesn't think he needs. Then who are the ones who pursue wisdom, Diotima, I said, if it's neither the wise nor the ignorant? That much is obvious even to a child, she said. It's those in between the two, and Love would be among them. For wisdom is one of the most beautiful things, and Love is love directed at what's beautiful. So Love must necessarily be a lover of wisdom, and being a lover of wisdom, he's between being wise and being ignorant. And the reason for this too lies in his birth. His father is wise and resourceful, his mother lacks wisdom and means.
So that, dear Socrates, is the nature of this spirit.
As for what you supposed Love to be, it's no wonder you were mistaken. From what you've said, I gather you supposed that the beloved was Love, not the one who loves. That's why I think Love seemed to you altogether beautiful. For what is lovable is truly beautiful, delicate, perfect, and blessed. But what does the loving is a different sort of thing altogether, the sort I've just described. And I said, well then, stranger, for what you say is well said. If Love is such as you describe, what use is he to human beings?
That, Socrates, she said, is what I'll try to teach you next.
Love is indeed of this nature and this birth, and he's directed at beautiful things, as you say. But suppose someone asked us, in what way, Socrates and Diotima, is Love directed at beautiful things? Or to put it more clearly, the lover loves beautiful things, but what does he want from them? And I said that he wants them to become his own. But that answer, she said, still calls for a further question. What will happen to the man who gets the beautiful things he wants? I said I wasn't at all ready to answer that question offhand. Well, she said, suppose someone changed the question using good instead of beautiful and asked, tell me, Socrates, the lover loves good things, but what does he want from them? To have them become his own, I said. And what will happen to the man who gets the good things he wants? That one I can answer more readily, I said. He'll be happy. Yes, she said, the happy are happy by possessing good things, and there's no need to go on asking for what purpose someone wants to be happy. The answer seems to be final. That's true, I said. Now this wish and this love, do you think it's common to all human beings, and that everyone wants good things to be theirs always, or how do you put it? Just that, I said, it's common to everyone. Then why, Socrates, she said, don't we say that everyone loves, if indeed everyone loves the same things always? Instead we say some people love and others don't. I wonder about that myself, I said. Don't wonder, she said. We take one particular form of love and call it by the name as the whole, love, while for the other forms we use other names.
Like what? I said. Like this.
You know that poetry, Pieces, covers a great deal, since whatever is responsible for bringing anything at all out of not being into being is a kind of making, so that all the productive work done under every craft is a kind of making, and all their practitioners are makers.
True.
And yet, she said, you know they're not called makers, but have other names, and only one part singled out from the whole of making, the part concerned with music and verse, is called by the name of the whole. This alone is called poetry, and those who possess this part of making are called poets.
True, I said.
So it is with love as well. In the broadest sense, all desire for good things and for happiness is love, and it's the greatest and most seductive love there is in everyone. But those who pursue it by other paths, through making money, or through devotion to athletics, or through philosophy, aren't said to be in love or called lovers, while those who go after it in one particular way and are devoted to it get the name of the whole, love, being in love, lovers.
You're probably right, I said.
There is a story told, she said, that those who seek their other half are the ones who love. But my account says that love is not of a half, nor of a whole, unless, my friend, that half or whole happens to be good, since people are quite willing to have their own feet and hands cut off if they think their own parts are diseased. For I don't think people cherish what's their own, unless someone means by his own the good, and by not his own the bad, since the only thing people love is the good.
Or do you think otherwise?
By Zeus, not I said. Then can we simply say that people love the good?
Yes, I said.
But shouldn't we add, she said, that they love the good to be theirs?
We should add that.
And not only that it be theirs, she said, but that it be theirs forever.
That too must be added.
In sum, then, she said, love is of having the good be one's own forever. What you say is entirely true, I said. Since this, then, is always what love is, she said, in what way and in what activity is the eagerness and intensity of those who pursue it to be called love?
What exactly is this activity? Can you say?
If I could, I said, Diotima, I wouldn't be marveling at your wisdom and coming to you to learn just these things.
Well, I'll tell you, she said.
It is giving birth in beauty, both in body and in soul. It would take a diviner than me, I said, to know what you mean. I don't follow.
Then I'll put it more plainly, she said.
All human beings, Socrates, are pregnant both in body and in soul, and when we reach a certain age, our nature desires to give birth. It cannot give birth in what is ugly, only in what is beautiful.
The union of a man and a woman is, after all, a kind of birth. This is something divine. This act of conceiving and begetting is an immortal thing present within a mortal creature. But it cannot occur in what is discordant. What is ugly is discordant with everything divine, while the beautiful is in harmony with it. So beauty is a kind of fate and birth goddess presiding over generation. That's why when the pregnant thing draws near something beautiful, it becomes gracious and melts with joy and gives birth and begets. But when it draws near something ugly, it shrinks back, scowling and grieved, turns away and curls in on itself, and does not beget, but holds its burden painfully. That's why in the one who is pregnant and already teeming, there's such intense excitement over beauty, because it releases the one who holds it from a great birth pang. For love, Socrates, she said, is not as you think of the beautiful. Then of what? Of begetting and bringing to birth in the beautiful. Well, I said. Just so, she said. So why birth? Because birth is the only way a mortal thing can share in perpetuity and immortality. And it follows from what we've agreed, that love is always love of possessing the good for oneself, that love must also be love of immortality, since it's love of the good. All this she taught me whenever she spoke about matters of love. And once she asked, "What do you suppose causes this love and desire, Socrates? Don't you notice the strange state every animal falls into when it wants to breed, land animals and birds alike, how sick with love they all become, first to mate with one another, then to feed what's born? The weakest creatures are ready to fight the strongest over this, ready to die for it, to starve themselves half to death so as to raise their young, and to do absolutely anything else. Humans, you might suppose, do this out of reasoning. But animals, what causes such a lovesick state in them? Can you say?" And I told her again that I didn't know. "Do you really expect," she said, "to become a master of love someday if you haven't worked this out? But that's exactly why I've come to you, Diotima, as I said before, because I know I need teachers. So tell me the cause of this and of the other facts about love." "Well," she said, "if you believe that love is by nature love of what we've repeatedly agreed it loves, don't be surprised. Because here too, on the same principle, mortal nature seeks, as far as it can, to exist forever and be immortal. And it can do this only one way, through generation, since it always leaves behind something new in place of the old. Even in the time one single living thing is said to live and be itself, as a person is called the same from childhood to old age, that person, even though he never has the same things in himself, is nonetheless still called the same, though he's always becoming new and losing other parts, in hair, flesh, bones, blood, and his whole body. And it isn't just the body, in the soul too, habits, character, opinions, desires, pleasures, pains, fears, none of these ever stay the same in any one person. Some are coming into being while others are perishing. And stranger still than these is the case of knowledge itself. Not only do some branches of knowledge come to be in us while others perish, so that we're never even the same with respect to what we know, but each single piece of knowledge undergoes the very same thing. What we call studying exists because knowledge is leaving us. Forgetting is the departure of knowledge, and studying, by putting a fresh memory back in place of the one that's leaving, preserves the knowledge, so that it seems to be the same. It's in this way that everything mortal is preserved, not by staying completely and forever the same, as the divine does, but by what is departing and aging, leaving behind something new, of the same kind as it was. "By this device, Socrates," she said, "a mortal thing shares in immortality, both in body and in everything else. The immortal shares in it differently. So don't be surprised that everything by nature prizes its own offshoot. This eagerness, this love, exists in all things for the sake of immortality." Hearing this argument, I was amazed and said, "Well now, wisest Diotima, is this really true?
And she, like a practiced sophist, said, "Be assured of it, Socrates. Just look at human ambition, if you want, you'd be amazed at its irrationality, unless you keep in mind what I've said, and consider how strangely people are affected by the desire to become famous and to lay up undying glory for all time. For this, they're ready to run every risk, even more than for their children, to spend money, endure any hardship, and even die. Do you think Alcestis would have died for Admetus, or Achilles would have died along with Patroclus, or your own Codrus would have died before his time to preserve the kingship for his sons, if they hadn't expected to win an undying memory for their courage, the very memory we still hold of them? Far from it," she said. "I think everyone does everything for the sake of undying excellence and this kind of glorious reputation, and the better people are, the more they do it, for they are in love with immortality. Now those who are pregnant in body," she said, "turn more toward women and are lovers in that way, providing themselves, as they suppose, with immortality, remembrance, and happiness for all future time through having children. But there are others who are pregnant in soul, for indeed," she said, "there are those whose souls are pregnant even more than their bodies, pregnant with what is fitting for a soul to conceive and bear."
"And what is fitting?"
"Wisdom and excellence, in general. Of these the poets are all begetters, and so are all the craftsmen said to be inventive. But by far the greatest and most beautiful branch of wisdom," she said, "is the one concerned with the ordering of cities and households, which goes by the names moderation and justice. When someone has been pregnant in soul with these from youth, being still unmarried and of ripe age, and desires now to bear and beget, he too, I think, goes about seeking the beautiful thing in which he might beget, for he will never beget in what is ugly. So being pregnant, he welcomes beautiful bodies rather than ugly ones, and if he also meets a soul that's beautiful, noble, and well-formed, he welcomes the combination eagerly, and for such a person he's immediately full of things to say about excellence, about what a good man ought to be and what he ought to practice, and he sets about educating him. For by being in contact with beauty, I think, and keeping company with it, he brings to birth what he had long been carrying, remembering it whether present or absent, and joins with that person in raising what has been born, so that people like this share a far greater bond with one another than parents share through children, and a firmer friendship, since they have shared in children more beautiful and more immortal. And everyone would rather have such children of his own than human ones, looking to Homer and Hesiod and the other good poets, and envying the kind of offspring they leave behind, which grant them undying fame and remembrance, being themselves of such a kind. Or if you like," she said, "consider what children Lycurgus left behind in Sparta, saviors of Sparta and virtually of all Greece. Solon, too, is honored among you for having fathered your laws, and so are many other men elsewhere, among both Greeks and non-Greeks, who have brought many fine achievements to light and begotten every kind of excellence. Temples have already been raised to many of them because of such children, but never yet because of human ones. These matters of love, Socrates, are perhaps ones into which even you could be initiated. But whether you're capable of the final, revealed mysteries, for whose sake these very things exist if one pursues them rightly, I don't know. I will tell you," she said, "and spare no eagerness, try to follow if you can. The one who goes about this rightly must begin, while young, by going toward beautiful bodies, and first, if his guide leads him rightly, he should love one single body and there beget beautiful discourse. Next, he must notice that the beauty found in any body whatever is akin to the beauty found in another, and that if he's to pursue beauty of form, it's great folly not to consider the beauty found in all bodies to be one and the same. Having grasped this, he must become a lover of all beautiful bodies and relax the intensity of his passion for just one, thinking little of it. After this, he must come to regard beauty in souls as more valuable than beauty in the body, so that if someone is decent in soul, even with little bloom of body, that's enough for him, and he'll love and cherish him, and beget discourses of the sort that make young people better, and seek them,
so that he's forced in turn to gaze upon the beauty in practices and laws, and to see that this too is all akin to itself, so that he comes to regard bodily beauty as a small thing. After practices, he must be led on to the branches of knowledge, so that he may see in turn the beauty of these, and looking now toward beauty in its vastness, may no longer be a slave, fixed like a servant on the beauty of one boy, one person, or one practice, mean and small-minded, but turn toward the great open sea of beauty, and gazing upon it, may give birth to many beautiful and magnificent discourses and thoughts in a philosophy without stint, until having grown strong and full there. He catches sight of a single kind of knowledge, one of this sort, the knowledge of a beauty I'm about to describe. "Try now," she said, "to pay me the closest attention you can. Whoever has been guided this far in matters of love, viewing beautiful things one after another and in the right order, will now, as he comes to the very end of the ascent, suddenly catch sight of something wonderfully beautiful in its nature. The very thing, Socrates, for whose sake all the earlier labors were undertaken. It is first eternal, neither coming to be nor perishing, neither growing nor diminishing, and next, not beautiful in one respect and ugly in another, nor beautiful at one time and not at another, nor beautiful in relation to one thing and ugly in relation to another, nor beautiful here and ugly there, as though it were beautiful to some and ugly to others. Nor again will this beauty appear to him in the shape of a face, or hands, or anything else the body partakes of, nor as any statement or piece of knowledge, nor as residing in anything else, such as in a living creature, or in earth, or in heaven, or in anything at all but itself by itself with itself, single in form forever, while all the other beautiful things share in it in such a way that, though they come to be and pass away, it becomes no greater or less, and undergoes nothing at all. Whenever someone, rising by right love of boys from these particulars, begins to catch sight of that beauty, he is nearly touching the goal. For this is what it means to go rightly toward matters of love, or to be led by another, beginning from these beautiful particulars and always climbing upward for the sake of that beauty, as though using rungs of a ladder, from one body to two, and from two to all beautiful bodies, and from beautiful bodies to beautiful practices, and from practices to beautiful branches of learning, until from these branches of learning one arrives at that final learning, which is learning of nothing other than that beauty itself, and comes to know, at last, what beauty itself is. This, dear Socrates, said the woman of Mantinea, if anywhere, is the point in life where it is worth living for a human being, when he gazes upon beauty itself. If you ever see it, it will not seem to you to be on the level of gold, clothing, or beautiful boys and young men, the sight of whom now so overwhelms you and everyone else that you're ready, gazing at your beloved and staying always in his company, if it were somehow possible to give up food and drink altogether, just to look at him and be with him. What then, she said, do we imagine it would be like if someone got to see the beautiful itself, unmixed, pure, unadulterated, not stuffed full of human flesh and colors and a great deal of other mortal nonsense, but able to see the divine beauty itself, single in its form? Do you think, she said, that a person's life is worthless when he looks toward that vision and beholds it in the way he should and lives in its company? Don't you realize, she said, that there, and only there, seeing beauty with the faculty that can see it, he will be able to bring to birth not images of virtue, since he is not grasping an image, but true virtue, since he grasps the truth. And to the one who gives birth to true virtue and nurtures it, it falls to become dear to the gods, and if any human being ever becomes immortal, it is he. This, then, Phaedrus and the rest of you, is what Diotima told me, and I am convinced of it. And being convinced, I try to persuade others too, that for acquiring this good, human nature, could not easily find a better partner than Eros. That is why I say every man should honor love, and why I myself honor the things of love and pursue them above everything else, and urge others to do the same, and why now and always I praise the power and courage of Eros as far as I am able. Take this speech, Phaedrus, if you like, as a formal tribute to love, or if you prefer to call it something else, call it whatever pleases you. When Socrates had finished, the others applauded, but Aristophanes tried to say something, since Socrates had mentioned him earlier in his speech. But just then, there came a loud knocking at the courtyard door, as of revelers, and the sound of a flute girl could be heard. "Go and see who it is," Agathon said to the slaves. "If it's one of our friends, invite him in. Otherwise tell them we've stopped drinking and are already resting." Not long after, they heard Alcibiades' voice in the courtyard, very drunk and shouting loudly, asking where Agathon was and demanding to be taken to him. So the flute girl and some of his other companions supported him and brought him in, and he appeared in the doorway crowned with a thick wreath of ivy and violets, with a great many ribbons on his head, and said, "Greetings, gentlemen. Will you take on a drinking companion who is thoroughly drunk, or should we just leave, once we've crowned Agathon, which is what we came for?" "I wasn't able to come yesterday," he said, "but now I'm here with these ribbons on my head, so that I can take them from my own head and bind them around the head of the wisest and most beautiful man here, if I may put it that way. Will you all laugh at me for being drunk?" "Well, laugh if you like. I still know perfectly well that I'm telling the truth. But tell me right now, on these terms, do I come in or not? Will you drink with me or won't you?" Everyone shouted out in encouragement and told him to come in and take a seat, and Agathon called him over personally. So he went in, led by his companions, and as he was undoing the ribbons to crown Agathon, they fell in front of his eyes so that he didn't notice Socrates, and he sat down next to Agathon, between him and Socrates, for Socrates had moved aside when he saw him coming. Sitting down beside Agathon, he embraced him and put the wreath on his head. "Slaves," said Agathon, "take off Alcibiades' sandals so he can recline here as a third with us." "By all means," said Alcibiades, "but who is this third drinking companion of ours?" And as he turned around he saw Socrates, and on seeing him he jumped up and cried, "Heracles, what is this? Socrates, you are lying in wait for me here, just like you always do, suddenly turning up wherever I least expect you. And now, why have you come? And why did you take this particular spot, instead of next to Aristophanes or someone else who's funny and wants to be, but managed to arrange it so you're reclining next to the most beautiful person in the room?" "Agathon," said Socrates, "see if you can defend me. Loving this man has become no small trouble for me. From the moment I fell in love with him, I haven't been allowed so much as to look at a handsome man or talk to one, or he flies into a jealous rage and makes an awful scene, hurling abuse and practically laying his hands on me. So watch that he doesn't do something now to make peace between us, or if he tries to use force, protect me, because his lover's madness and possessiveness terrify me." "There will be no peace between you and me," said Alcibiades. "But I'll get you back for this some other time. For now, Agathon," he said, "give me some of those ribbons so I can crown this remarkable head of his too, and he won't complain that I crowned you but failed to crown him, a man who defeats everyone in argument, not just once, the other day, the way you did, but always." And taking some of the ribbons, he crowned Socrates and settled down to recline. Once he was settled, he said, "Well now, gentlemen, you seem to me to be sober. That can't be allowed. You must drink, since that was our agreement. So I appoint myself master of the drinking, until you've all had enough. Agathon, have them bring me a large cup, if there is one. Actually, never mind, just bring me that wine cooler," he said, once he'd spotted it holding more than 8 cartuli. He had it filled and drained it himself first, then told them to pour for Socrates, saying as he did, "Against Socrates, gentlemen, my trick is useless. He'll drink however much you tell him to and never get any more drunk for it." So the slave poured for Socrates, and he drank. Then Eryximachus said,
What are we doing, Alcibiades? Are we just going to drink like this, without a word said or a song sung over the cup, the way thirsty men do? And Alcibiades replied, Eryximachus, best son of the best and most temperate of fathers, greetings. And to you as well, said Eryximachus. But what should we do? Whatever you say. We ought to obey you. A physician is worth many other men, so give whatever order you like. Listen then, said Eryximachus. Before you came in, we decided that each of us in turn, going around to the right, should give the best speech he could in praise of Eros. The rest of us have all spoken already. Since you haven't spoken, and you've had your drink, it's only fair that you speak now, and once you've spoken, you can set Socrates whatever task you like, and he can set one for the man on his right, and so around the circle. That's all very well, Eryximachus, said Alcibiades, but it's hardly fair to match a drunk man's speeches against sober men's. Besides, my dear fellow, surely Socrates hasn't talked you into believing what he just said. Don't you know the truth is the exact opposite of what he claimed? He's the one, if I praise anyone in his presence, God or man, other than himself, he won't keep his hands off me. Watch your tongue, said Socrates. By Poseidon, said Alcibiades, don't try to stop me, since I wouldn't praise anyone else while you're here, not a single person. Well, do that then, if you like, said Eryximachus. Praise Socrates. You mean it, said Alcibiades. You think I should, Eryximachus. Should I attack the man and get my revenge in front of you all? Here, said Socrates, what have you got in mind? Are you going to praise me just to make me look ridiculous? Or what will you do? I'll tell the truth. See if you'll allow that. Well, the truth, certainly, that I allow, and I insist on it. Then I won't hold back, said Alcibiades. And you do this for me. If I say anything untrue, stop me partway through if you like, and say that I'm lying there, because I won't lie on purpose. But if I jump from one thing to another as memories come to me, don't be surprised. It isn't easy for someone in my condition to list your peculiarities smoothly and in order. I'm going to try to praise Socrates, gentlemen, in this way, through images. He'll probably think I mean it to make him look ridiculous, but the image is for the sake of truth, not ridicule. I say he's most like those figures of Silenus you find sitting in the sculptor's shops, the ones the craftsmen make holding pipes or flutes, which open up in the middle to reveal images of the gods inside. And I also say he's like the satyr Marsyas. Now that you resemble them in appearance, Socrates, you surely won't dispute yourself, but hear how you resemble them in other ways too. You're an insolent fellow, aren't you? If you deny it, I'll produce witnesses. And aren't you a flute player? Far more remarkable than Marsyas was. He used instruments to charm people through the power coming from his mouth, and so does anyone today who plays what he used to play, for what Olympus played, I mean, was taught to him by Marsyas. So whether it's a good flute player or a poor flute girl playing his tunes, they alone can possess people and reveal who needs the gods and their rites, because they are themselves something divine. You differ from him only in this. You do the very same thing with bare words, without any instrument. Whenever we hear anyone else speak, even a very good speaker giving other speeches, it means practically nothing to any of us. But when someone hears you, or hears your words repeated by someone else, even if the speaker is quite poor, whether it's a woman listening, or a man, or a young boy, we're struck dumb and possessed. As for me, gentlemen, if I weren't afraid you'd think I was hopelessly drunk, I would swear to you and tell you what I myself have suffered from his words, and still suffer even now. When I listen to him, my heart pounds far more than it does for the Corybantic dancers, and tears pour out of me because of what he says, and I see a great many others experiencing the same thing.
When I listened to Pericles and other fine speakers, I thought they spoke well, but I never felt anything like this. My soul was never thrown into turmoil, never indignant at being kept, as it were, in slavish subjection. But this Marcius here has often put me in such a state that I've felt life wasn't worth living, the way I'm living it. And you won't say this isn't true, Socrates. Even now I know within myself that if I were willing to lend him my ears, I couldn't hold out. I'd feel the very same thing all over again. He forces me to admit that though I'm sorely lacking myself, I still neglect myself and instead handle the affairs of Athens. So by force, as if from the sirens, I stop up my ears and flee, so that I won't just sit there beside him and grow old. He's the only man alive who's made me feel something no one would think was in me, shame, in front of anyone at all. He's the only one I feel ashamed before. I know in myself that I have no way to argue that I shouldn't do what he tells me to do, and yet when I leave him, I'm overcome again by the honor the crowd gives me. So I run away from him and avoid him, and whenever I see him, I feel ashamed of what I've already admitted to be true. Many times I would gladly see him gone from among the living, and yet if that actually happened, I know I'd be far more grieved, so I simply don't know what to do with this man. That's how his flute playing has affected me and many others, this satyr's flute playing. But hear something else from me, how well he matches the things I compared him to, and what astonishing power he has. Know well that none of you really understands him. But I'll show you, since I've started. You see how Socrates is disposed erotically toward beautiful people, and always around them, struck with wonder, and yet he knows nothing at all, understands nothing, or so he'd have you believe. Isn't this very pose of his exactly like Silenus? Absolutely. That's just the outer shell he wraps himself in, like the carved figure of Silenus, but open him up, and how full of moderation do you think you'll find him inside, fellow drinkers? Know this, it doesn't matter to him in the least whether someone is beautiful. He looks down on that to a degree no one would believe, nor whether someone is rich, nor whether he holds any of the other honors the crowd considers blessed. He regards all these possessions as worth nothing, and regards us as nothing too, I tell you plainly, and he spends his whole life playing at irony, making a game of people. When he grew serious and opened up, I don't know if anyone has ever seen the figures inside him. I saw them once myself, and they struck me as so godlike, golden, so beautiful and astonishing, that whatever Socrates told me to do, I felt I simply had to do it. I assumed he was serious about my youthful looks, and I thought it was a windfall, an amazing stroke of luck for me, that by gratifying Socrates, I'd get to hear everything he knew, since I was tremendously proud of my looks at the time. So with that plan in mind, I stopped doing what I'd always done before, which was never to be alone with him without an attendant present. Now I sent the attendant away and met with him alone. I have to tell you the whole truth, so pay attention, and if I'm lying, Socrates, call me out. I met with him, gentlemen, alone with him alone, and I expected he'd immediately start talking to me the way a lover talks to his beloved when they're by themselves, and I was thrilled. But none of that happened at all. He'd just talk with me the way he always did, spend the day with me, and then leave. After that, I invited him to work out with me at the gym, and we trained together, thinking something might come of it that way. So he worked out with me, and even wrestled with me, often with no one else around, but why go on? Nothing came of it. Since I wasn't getting anywhere that way, I decided I had to go after the man more forcefully and not let up. Now that I'd started, I had to find out once and for all what this was about. So I invited him to dinner, exactly like a lover scheming against his beloved. He didn't even agree to that quickly, but eventually I talked him into it. The first time he came, he wanted to eat and leave right after. That time, I was too embarrassed to stop him. But I tried again after we'd eaten. I kept the conversation going late into the night, and when he wanted to leave, I claimed it was too late and forced him to stay. So he lay down to rest on the couch next to mine, the one where he'd had dinner, and no one else was sleeping in the room but the two of us. Up to this point in my story, it would be fine to tell it to anyone at all. But what comes next you wouldn't have heard from me if it weren't true. First, as the saying goes, that wine with or without children present speaks the truth. And second, because it seems unjust to me to hide away an act of Socrates' extraordinary pride once I've started praising him. And besides, I feel the way someone bitten by a snake feels. They say a man who suffered that won't describe what it was like, except to others who have been bitten too, since only they will understand and forgive him for anything he dared do or say because of the pain. Well, I've been bitten by something more painful, and in the most painful place, anyone can be bitten, struck and bitten in the heart, or the soul, or whatever you want to call it, by the words of philosophy, which grip harder than any snake once they take hold of a young soul with some natural gift, and make it do and say anything at all. And I look around and see Phaedrus's, Agathon's, Eryximachus's, Pausanias's, Aristodemus's, and Aristophanes's here, not to mention Socrates himself, and everyone else. All of you have shared in this philosophically madness, this Bacchic frenzy, which is why you'll all listen. You'll forgive both what was done back then and what's being said now. But you slaves, and anyone else who's uninitiated and coarse, shut great big doors over your ears. Once the lamp had gone out, gentlemen, and the slaves had left, I decided there was no point being clever with him, I'd just say freely what I had in mind. So I shook him and said, "Socrates, are you asleep?" "Not at all," he said. "Do you know what I've decided?"
"What exactly?" he said.
"I think," I said, "that you're the only lover who's ever been worthy of me, and you seem to be holding back from mentioning it to me. Here's how I feel about it. I think it would be completely foolish of me not to grant you this favor, or anything else you might need from my property or my friends. Nothing matters more to me than becoming as good as possible, and I don't think anyone could help me toward that more than you. I'd be far more ashamed in front of sensible people for not granting a favor to a man like you than I would be in front of the masses and the foolish for granting it." Hearing this, he answered in that thoroughly ironic way of his, so typical of him, "My dear Alcibiades, you may really turn out not to be worthless if what you say about me happens to be true, and there really is some power in me that could make you better. You must be seeing an impossible kind of beauty in me, one very different from the good looks you have. Now, if you've noticed that, and you're trying to strike a deal with me, exchanging beauty for beauty, you're planning to get a lot more than your share out of me. You're trying to get true beauty in exchange for its mere appearance, and really planning to trade bronze for gold. But look more carefully, my blessed friend, so I don't slip past you as being worth nothing. The mind's sight starts to see clearly only when the eye's sharpness begins to fade, and you're still a long way from that." Hearing this, I said, "Well, that's my side of things, and none of it was said any way other than how I actually think. Now it's up to you to decide what's best for both of us." "Well," he said, "that's a good point. In the time to come, we'll think it over and do whatever seems best to us both, about this and everything else." So after this exchange, having said my piece and let fly what I thought were arrows, I figured I'd wounded him. I got up, and without even letting him say another word, I wrapped my own cloak around him. It was winter, lay down under his worn coat, threw my arms around this truly superhuman and remarkable man, and spent the whole night lying there like that. And you won't say I'm lying about this either, Socrates. But after I'd done all that, he got the better of me so completely that he scorned and mocked my youthful beauty and treated it with contempt.
and that beauty was the one thing I thought I had going for me, gentlemen of the jury. Yes, you're the jury judging Socrates' arrogance. Know this well, by the gods and goddesses. I got up from sleeping with Socrates, having experienced nothing more than if I'd slept beside my own father or older brother. What do you suppose my state of mind was after that? Feeling that I'd been insulted, yet admiring his nature, his self-control, his courage, having met a man the likes of whom I never thought I'd encounter, for wisdom and endurance. So I couldn't bring myself to be angry with him and cut myself off from his company, nor could I find a way to win him over. I knew very well that he was far harder to wound with money than Ajax was with iron, and the one weapon I thought would surely catch him had failed me. So I was at a loss, enslaved by this man as no one has ever been enslaved by anyone else. All this had already happened to me, and after it, we were sent together on campaign to Potidaea, and we messed together there.